Part 2. The Last Oasis. Lake Gosul. Imperial Year 773.M41. Day 261. Today 264. Chapter 10. Day 261. Lake Gosul. FSB 0532.
Get up! Wake the hell up! The urgent whisper said.
Vander Markwell blinked and rolled over. Van Tull was leaning over him in the violet gloom of the tent, shaking him by the shoulder.
What? What?
Cover drill,
the older pilot hissed. He tapped the aluminoid bracelet around his wrist.
Didn't your alarm wake you?
Markwell yawned and shook his head. He glanced down at his own metal strap, which was dormant. Van Tull's had a red rune illuminated on its cover.
I think mine's broken, Markwell decided.
Van Tull scowled at Markwell, then took him firmly by the wrist and unclasped the bracelet. He studied it for a moment, then tossed it back to the boy.
You'll have to get a new one from stores. Not now, later. Come on.
Van Tull opened the flap seal of the habitent and let light and warm air in. He was already dressed. Markwell pulled on his breeches and looked around for his boots.
Come on, Van Tull called.
Markwell yanked on his boots, but there was no time to fasten them. He hurried outside after Van Tull. The habitent they shared was one of almost 150 camo-skinned shelter domes that clogged the ground under the stands of dripping kinderwood trees. Even though it was early still, the air was humid. Bright sunlight filtered down through the lacy leaf canopy and the blast nets strung between the tree trunks, like a roof over the shelters. The pair of them ran through the mottled shadows, keeping carefully to the flat board planking where the path crossed the frequent marshy pits and swamp pools. Scops hissed around them like vox static. As they ran, Markwell saw dark shapes loom out of the twilight groves around them, dark shapes deliberately concealed. More shelters, camouflaged supply dumps, Hydra AA batteries, where the crews waited silent and alert, the veiled shapes of warplanes under shimmer netting. They reached the shelter and scrambled inside. The pilots of Umbra and a gang of fitters were huddled within.
Overslept? Asked Jagdeer.
My fault, Commander, said Van Tull.
Really?
Markwell's tag was defective and I was slow waking him.
I think that rather makes it Markwell's fault, doesn't it?
Jagdeer said, looking sourly at the half-dressed boy with his unlaced boots.
Sorry, Mamzo.
Shut it,
Jagdeer said. Human silence draped them. Outside the blast shelter, the forest trembled with birdsong and odd animal cries. Markwell had already decided he didn't like this place. Hot, wet, stinking of rotten fruit. His skin itched. He'd seen bugs the size of fingers crawling on the walls of his habitent, and, during the night, swarms of silk-winged beetles flitting around the downlights of the camp's stealth lamps. The birds fell silent. Markwell heard the low whir of a nearby Hydra platform as it traversed slowly. Then the sound of jet wash, low, passing overhead. The distinctive warbling note of enemy vector thrusters. In a moment it was gone. A muffled vox signal.
Understood, Blanchard said, removing his headset. All clear, he reported.
Relieved conversations started up. Activity resumed. The occupants of the shelter began to file out. The runes on all their bracelets had turned green.
Begin day duties, please, Jagdeer announced. Briefing at 06:30, but get fed and washed quickly. Snap calls can come in at any time. Markwell?
Yes, Commander.
Go to the stores right now and get a new tag. Before you leave stores, press the test switch and make sure it works. If it doesn't, get another one. Do you understand?
I do, Commander.
Funny, I thought you'd understood last night, when I told you the first time.
I was slack, Commander. It won't happen again.
Carry on, she said. He turned. Wait.
He sighed and turned back. She was frowning.
Closer. Right here. Turn around.
She examined the skin of his shoulders where the vest exposed it, then pulled up the hem and looked at his back.
You have a dermal condition I should know about? She asked.
No, Mamzel.
Then it's scot bites. They say some people get them worse than others. The sweet-tasting ones. Are you sweet-tasting, Markwell?
Don't know, Mamzelle.
The scops seem to think so. See the base Medicaid while you're about it.
Yes, Mamzelle.
Markwell laced up his boots properly and then trudged through the base. Now the risk of discovery had passed, the place felt more like a functioning airbase. Personnel hurried about on the boardwalks, and teams of fitters unwrapped hidden machines and resumed work on them. The smell of promethium almost overwhelmed the scent of the swamp. The forward strike base, a makeshift encampment, lurked secretly in the Kinderwood forests on the southern shore of Lake Gosell. The lake itself, immense and nearly 1,000 kilometers east to west, was fed by headwaters coming down from the Macanites, and in turn emptied into the Saroya River to drain into the sea on the faraway western coast. This great system of rivers and lakes, around which flourished a gigantic swathe of rainforest, formed a margin between the interior desert to the south and the scrubby, temperate peninsula to the north, an enveloping greenbelt in which they could hide and then strike at anything that passed over. The vast lake itself, so wide the far shore was all but a smudge, was visible between the thinning shore trees, a broad expanse of sunlit green. The entire territory was swampy and bug-thick, miasmal black ooze and pools of stagnant water interlacing the jumbled kinder groves. Beyond the lake, to the east, Markwell glimpsed the lazy flanks of the Macanites, dust yellow in the rising sun. Navy pioneer units and Munitorum work crews had built a surprising amount at Gosell. Prefab HAB modules, defense batteries, bunkers and covered hangars nestled under the trees and the ubiquitous shimmer nets. Modar stacks and vox masts poked discreetly above the leaf cover, or had been raised as cable-form aerials, cleated to the trees themselves. Clearings had been cut, dozens of them, each one leveled and decked with heavyweight vulcanized matting. Thick gray material rolled out to form temporary hardstands. On each stand sat a warplane. The 10 Thunderbolts of Umbra Flight, the 12 of the Navy 409th, Raptors, and the 8 Lightnings from the 786th Spyglass Recon. Unless unshrouded for launch or landing, each mat-decked clearing was all but invisible from the air, thanks to the camo awnings. Bulk landers for support crew transfers, base supply, and fuel and munitions deliveries used the wide, muddy beach of the lakeshore, not needing to stay on station for more than a few minutes. There was no way a permanent, large-scale mat deck could be concealed from the air. Sentinel power lifters, striding through the mire, did all the base's heavy lifting and carrying. The FSB had a decent ring of tarantula sentry guns watching the forest around it, as well as 2 dozen Manticore and Hydra anti-aircraft batteries. With the PDF troopers needed to man all these, the 30 pilots, the fitter teams, and forward operational personnel, Lake Gosell FSB had a population of over 200. "Hey, killer, where are you going?" Markwell looked round and saw Larice Ash jogging up behind him along the flak boarding. "Stores," he said. Privately, he was in awe of Flight Lieutenant Larice Ash. She seemed so damn tough. Jagdeer was a multi-kill vet too, but he mainly respected her because she was in charge. Ash, an ace before the liberation of Fantine had even finished, was the real thing, respected by all for her sheer talent. And young too. Blanchard had a huge tally, but he was an old guy. Larice seemed not much older than Markwell himself. She was lean and gamine, with bony cheeks and a vicious, toothy grin. The previous afternoon, before they'd shipped out to Gosell, she'd had her famous blonde hair shaved down to a finger width. "Jungle lice," she'd announced, adding, "do not want them." "The med station's near stores, isn't it?" she asked him.
"I think so."
"I'll tag along. So much for precautions."
"What?"
She ran a hand through her brutally cropped hair. "For this."
"How so?"
She pulled off her jacket and showed him the multiple bites on her bare forearms.
"Scops," he said.
"So they say."
"Me too,"
he said, dropping his flight coat off one arm and showing her his shoulder.
"Bitching,"
she said. The Munitorum station was a ring of hardened prefabs standing in the blue shadows of a massive frond tree. They went inside, into the air-scrubbed cool. The duty attendant, his face full of ancient augmetics, looked up from his cogitator.
"I need a new tag," Markwell said. "I believe, pilot officer, you mean you need a new tag, please, senior."
What?
"I am Senior Lyrek. You will address me civilly."
Markwell glanced at his chronometer. "There's a war on," he said. Ash sniggered.
"Indeed there is. And has civility run out? Where would the Navy be without the constant efforts of the Munitorum?"
"I have no idea," said Markwell.
"Ah, indeed,"
Lyrek said, rising to his feet and adjusting his heavy optics manually.
"You expect us to be at your beck and call and want this and want that, but..."
Do you know who that is?
Larice hissed at the old man.
No.
Larice, Markwell began nervously.
That's only Markwell,
Ash continued, her eyes fake wide.
Killer Markwell? The one who, you know.
No, mumbled Lyrek. I'm not sure I do.
The one who made the kill, said Ash.
The kill?
The kill. The kill. For throne's sake. And you talk about respect.
No, well, yes,
stammered the Munitorum senior, suddenly.
I forget myself. Your device, sir?
It doesn't work, said Markwell, handing his bracelet over.
So it doesn't. A terrible oversight. Wait one moment, if you will.
Lyrek came back with a fresh tag unit.
Yes, sir. I have tested it. In the event of a cover warning, it will illuminate, and as required, silently alert or wake you by a gentle, non-harmful electric pulse.
Markwell signed for it.
Thank you, he said.
I live to serve, sir,
Lyrek said, his tortoise head bowing. Outside, Ash started snickering.
What did you do that for?
It got you your tag, didn't it? She asked.
Yeah, but you lied. Have you made a kill or not? Yes. Then I didn't lie. What does he know?
You're bad, Larice Ash.
So they say.
Next door to the stores, a long prefab huddled under the shimmer hoods. A tall man in early middle age, well-made and masculine, sat on the entrance steps. His arms were folded on his knees, and his head rested on his arms. His hair was matted with what looked like dry clay, forming dreadlocks. He wore the blue silk robes of an Ayatani, one of the Beatty's priesthood.
Father, said Markwell, is the Medicae in?
He's out, answered the priest.
Maybe we can leave him a note, Markwell suggested to Ash.
No, I gotta find something. These bites are killing me.
They went into the med block. All the surfaces were polished steel and swabbed plastic. The circulating air smelled of mint. Ash began to rifle through the drug cabinets.
What are you doing?
The Ayatani stood behind them in the doorway.
Helping myself, said Ash.
I told you the Medicae was out.
Yeah, you did.
Now he's in again.
They both looked at the tall priest. He raised a hand and shook back his sleeve to reveal a Navy-issue ident cuff. Divisio Medicae.
I am Ayatani Kaltas. I also happen to be serving Medicae at this FSB. Take your filthy hands out of my drugstore.
Ash jumped back, causing boxed packets to scatter on the grill floor.
What's the problem?
The priest snapped.
Scop bites, said Markwell,
starting to turn to show the practitioner his blisters. Kaltas strode past, ignoring him. He picked up two tubes of salve and threw them at Markwell. The boy caught them, just.
Twice a day, he snarled. Don't come back unless you get crotch rot.
Thank you, Father,
Markwell began.
Piss off, looters.
What was all that about?
Ash said as they walked away.
I'm not sure, Markwell said. Oh, who cares?
Ash smiled at him.
So, killer, what are you?
They both jumped as their tags went off, zapping their wrists and flashing the red rune.
Shit, cried Markwell. Who's on? Are you on? No,
said Ash, and pulled him towards the nearest shelter. Jagdeer was already in her bolt when the thrill hit her arm. On mat decks east and west of her, Blanche and Cordial stood by in their own machines. Her chief fitter closed her hood and gave her the sign of the Aquila. She sat in her machine, angled 75 degrees towards the sky on a hydraulic fast launch ramp. The base had three, all of them ready to answer a snap call at any time. Above, all she could see was sunlight playing through shimmer net. Her thumb rolled over the red toggle cover and rested on the rocket fire stud. She waited, sweat trickling down her face onto her mask. Silence. Heat. The distant stir of the forest.
Umbralina,
the vox began. Above her bird's elevated nose cone, the shimmer nets were suddenly drawing back and daylight spilling in. She knew the order before it was given.
You are go for launch.
Her thumb stabbed down. With a terrible punch and a roar, she left the world behind. The Cicatrice, 0650.
You're okay. You're okay. Trust me. What's the use, sir?
Asked Matrides.
I think he's going to die.
No, said Le Guin. I reckon he's just thirsty. Give him some water.
Matrides and Emdeen looked at him, unhappy.
We're down to the last recyc,
Emdeen said.
I know, said Le Guin.
I think we should have just left him where we found him,
Matridis said.
We're not leaving anyone, said Le Guin.
Damn it,
sighed M. Dean, and moved forward to dribble water from his flask into the prone man's cracked mouth.
Greta,
he moaned.
Greta.
Who's Greta?
Matridis wondered.
His girl,
suggested M. Dean.
What's his name?
Asked Le Guin. M. Dean reached into the man's scorched flight coat and pulled out a set of clinking imperial tags.
Viltry,
he said. Over the forests, 07-00. The forest canopy was like a vast green rug that had been rolled out over the top of boxes and furniture to form a soft, undulating mass. The three Thunderbolts skimmed as low as possible, following the contours of the tree mass, trying to keep below any ranged sensor cones. Their aftershock rocked and roiled the canopy like an angry sea, and flocks of disturbed avians and other flying creatures regularly mobbed out into the air like bursts of gaudy shrapnel. Blanche and Cordial kept their birds tucked close to Jagdia's lead. Umbra, Jagdia voxed. Turn 062 west. Contacts presenting at 19 kilometers and 6,000. Wait for my order to rise.
Read you lead.
Jagdia had a feeling something was not quite right, and it wasn't just the markedly different terrain. They were a good few minutes into the flight when she realized it was her own bolt. The parts of the nose and wings she could see from the cockpit. She wasn't yet used to the fact they were green. The crews at the FSB had sprayed them with a lime green wash to aid concealment. She was so used to a grey shape encasing her. Up in the cloudless blue, she caught a flash, a glint of sunlight on metal. A second later, she resolved tiny dots against the glare and traces of white contrail.
Umbra 2, lead. I see vapor trails at 3.
Got it, 2. The bastards are coming across above us. Weapons live, flight. Get ready to climb like hell.
5 specks. No, 6. Small. Razors, perhaps.
On my mark. 3, 2, mark.
The three pilots opened their throttles and heaved on their sticks, swinging the heavy thunderbolts up and away from the forest hood into the clear sky. Jagdia could see the hostiles plainly now. 6 locusts in cruise formation. Umbra was climbing as hard as their turbofans would allow, pressed firmly back in their seats. The bats appeared not to have seen them yet, but that would change very soon. Jagdia settled her hand around the stick grip, placing her thumb carefully on the fire stud. Intercept in 10 seconds. 9. 8. Suddenly, startled like the birds that their jets had scared out of the treetops, the bats broke. Their formation exploded, but Umbra was already committed.
Divide and conquer,
Jagdia instructed. She went straight up into the heart of the splitting pack, choosing a locust that was vivid amber and striped with gold. It was already turning out, but she had fine lead time. She banked slightly and let it fly into her sights. Squeeze. Electric blue, the las bursts zapped away from her nose cone. She let off 3 pairs of shots, and it was the second one that caught the locust squarely. Pieces of its hull flew off in a puff of smoke, and it flopped over on its back. Fire began to rush out of its underbelly, and it described a long, labored dive down into the rainforest. Jagdia saw a flash deep beneath the thick canopy, and smoke and steam broiled up out of the trees. Blanche's chosen target, a bright blue machine with vile yellow insignia, evaded his first blasts and managed a fine power dive under Blanche's trajectory that Umbra 2 couldn't hope to follow. Blanche swung around and started to chase a copper-colored locust that was fleeing south. He came up, but the locust was extending fast. The small enemy machines had a terrific turn of speed and climb rate. Blanche cursed, broke off, and rolled back into the brawl. Cordial was locked onto a crimson bat that was trying to shake him by diving towards the forest. Accepting the invitation, Cordial stooped, chasing the red speck into the green bosom of the forest. Leveling out at the treetops, the bat began to jink and switch, and Cordial had to stand his plane on one wingtip and then the other to stick fast. He punched off a shot, missed, corrected, and fired again. Another miss.
Tricksy little bastard,
Cordial muttered, wrenched back and forth by the centrifugal force of the constant turns. Above him, Jagdia was hunting down her second scalp. She had her eyes on a yellow bat that was breaking west, but abruptly rolled out as she heard a shrill lock warning. The blue locust Blanche had lost on his first pass was on her back, It fired twice, gleaming streamers of bolter fire, but she dodged out of line each time and finally managed to throw it by hitting her speed brakes and whiffing almost to a standstill. The blue hostile ripped by under her starboard wing, realized he'd been dummied, and broke right and high. Jagdia screwed over to follow its climb. The yellow bat had decided not to run after all, and had executed a vector turn high above, dropping in like an arrow to find a target. It had missed its chance with Jagdia, so it went for Cordial, who was still locked in the chase of the leaf line with a crimson locust. It hadn't even seen Blanche. Umbra too fell on it from above and behind, quad cannons alight. The locust shuddered painfully, its hull deformed by the stresses of the multiple impacts, and then blossomed like a flower into bright, radial petals of burning, expanding gas. At about the same moment, 1,000 meters higher up, Jagdia managed to pull off the most perfect Zygna turn, witnessed by no one, and came in true on the blue bat as it attempted one final slice roll to port. Her grouped shots ripped out its nose, then wrenched off a wing section. As it began to wobble, she fired a third burst that hit the locust directly under the cockpit mount on the port side. The entire cockpit assembly exploded. An ejector system must have fired, because she clearly saw a burning object fly straight up out of the stricken bat, and then fall away like a meteor. Empty, ruined, its pilot already incinerated, the locust folded up and rained down on the forest as 100,000 burning scraps. Two of the remaining bats had now fled south on full burn. The last live target was the crimson one that Cordial was pursuing over the trees.
"Need assist,"
Blanche voxed, rolling down.
"Negative two, negative, I've got him, tricksy little bastard."
Flying at zero over the canopy at close on 400 kph, Cordial whooped as he finally got a fleeting lock tone. He opened up. At precisely the same moment, his target's shock wash scared a flock of pink birds out of the trees. Cordial flew smack into them. They hit his plane like cannon shells. Plating fractured, the canopy smashed. One engine shrieked as feathered missiles clogged the intakes and buckled the whirring fans. There was a mist of blood.
"Shit!"
they heard Cordial yell. Jagdia and Blanche were already sweeping down after him. They both witnessed the odd pink flare of organic debris as his machine mowed into the flock. Cordial had hit the crimson locust, and it had promptly crashed at high speed into the trees. But none of them cared about that now.
"Cordial!"
Jagdia screamed. Umbra 11, hammered, one engine totaled, tried to correct, faltered, and hit the trees.
"Cordial! Cordial!"
Blanche could hear Jagdia yelling over the vox. Suddenly, almost impossibly, Umbra 11 reappeared, splashing out of the torn and thrashing greenery like a flying fish out of an ocean swell. Cordial had managed, against the odds, to keep the nose up and had ripped through the upper foliage of the canopy mass without striking a primary trunk. He began to climb, pouring a trail of brown smoke out of his port engine that soon turned white.
"Umbra 11! Still here, lead? Bastard bloody birds!"
19 minutes later, they settled back at the FSB. Blanche and Jagdia had nurse-maided Cordial's buckled, limping bolt all the way home. The camo shrouds drew back, exposing the matte deck hardstands like sockets in the green wilderness. The three Thunderbolts switched to vertical vector and sank gently onto their stands. As their fans powered down, the shimmer netting folded back over them. As soon as her stand controller gave her the hand signal for okay, Jagdia yanked out her vox and air plugs, climbed out of her cockpit, and jumped down onto the vulcanized mat. She tossed her helmet to the nearest fitter and ran out of the launch area along the decking under the trees. She reached Cordial's pad around the same time as Blanche. Umbra 11, venting steam and coiling plumes of vapor, was a mess. The canopy was wrecked and the nose armor pummeled. A team of fitters was spraying retardant foam into the clogged, burning engine. The forepart of the Thunderbolt was a mass of sticky black blood and tattered feathers. Cordial was climbing down. He was shaking. One bird carcass had punched through his canopy so hard it had smashed his visor and given him a black eye. He took off his helmet, dropped it, and wiped the treacly blood from his face. Then he squinted round at Jagdia and Blanche as they came up to him.
"Mental note," he said, wagging a finger at Jagdia. "Avoid birds wherever possible."
"Will do," she smiled.
Cordial reached around to the nose of his aircraft and peeled a pink feather out of the sticky mass plastered across it. He held it up.
"Lucky feather, anyone?"
Lake Gosel, FSB, 1642. The scops were killing him. He'd signed up to fight the archenemy of mankind, not microscopic flies. Everywhere he went, they surrounded him, unseen, filling his ears with a hiss like a tuned-out vox. His back was sore. He tried not to scratch, but Markwell wandered down to the lake shore, wondering if the filthy things would leave him alone out in the open. It didn't seem to help. The lake's beach was muddy and dimpled. Behind him, the dense rainforest rose like a rotting curtain. The sun was beginning to sink, turning the sky as rose-pink as Cordial's lucky bloody feathers. The lake was immense. It occurred to Markwell that he'd never seen a lake before. Standing water, that was a novelty. It was kind of like looking out across the Scald from the ports of a Fantine hive, except that it was so flat, so sheer. The vast green mirror had not changed colour as the sun set, but it had altered tonally. It was murky now, heavy, still. Slip snakes danced across its surface tension. Markwell wondered if he should go check on his bird, but the last time he'd seen 9-9, two Navy sentinels fitted out with paint tanks and wash guns in place of their regular lifting claws had been halfway through spraying it green. Markwell knelt at the shoreline and dipped his arms into the water. It was warm. He cupped his hands to wash his face.
"Don't do that, you cretin."
Markwell looked over his shoulder. The Ayatani was sitting on a promontory of rock behind him, his blue robes gathered about him. What was his name again? Cautus, was it? "Why shouldn't I?" Markwell asked.
"No reason. Go right ahead."
Markwell let the water fall out of his fingers and rose, wiping his hands dry on the legs of his trousers. "Come on, tell me."
"Byroxin byroxes," said the priest.
"Which is?"
"A microscopic water worm. The lake is lousy with them. If they enter the bloodstream, say through the mouth or nose or tear ducts, they infest the brain stem, multiplying at a prodigious rate, bursting blood vessels, severing neural pathways, and eventually causing such related symptoms as an inability to remember your own name, an inability to speak, an inability to regulate your own bowel movements, and an inability to live."
"Okay," Markwell said.
"Just so you know."
"I was just trying to wash off the scops."
"Lake mud."
"Pardon me?"
Cautus ran his fingers back through his own matted locks.
"Use lake mud. In your hair. That soon sends the scops off."
"Okay." Markwell paused. "Look, I want to say, I'm really sorry."
"About what?"
the Ayatani asked. "Going into your infirmary like that." "Assuming." Cautus shrugged. "Well, I'm sorry."
"Like I could actually, possibly, give a shit,"
the priest said, and walked away up the empty beach.
Lake Gosel, FSB, 1720. Bree Jagdeer was compiling reports in her habitant when the runner came to her.
"Message wafer, Mamzo," he said, holding it out.
"Commander," she corrected, taking it from him. She unfolded the wafer and read it.
"Anything interesting?"
Blanchard asked, wandering over from his own tent. The wafer read, "To Jagdeer, Commander, Fantine 20. I thought I should inform you that, at around 1300 hours this day, Captain Guis Gettering of the Apostles was lost in action. I think it appropriate that your boy might now be allowed to name his bird just as he likes. Sincerely, Seacan, Wing Commander."
"God Emperor," Jagdeer sighed. "Another one gone."
Lake Gosel FSB, 2112.
"How does that look?"
Rackley asked. He pulled off the last of the masking strips and tipped the nearest work lamp so that Markwell could see. Wisp moths furiously circled the blue light of the lamp.
"That's nice. That's great," Markwell said.
Along Serial 99's green flank, he could now see the Fantine Eagle crest and the stencil Double Eagle.
"All right."
"Really? God Emperor bless you. That's just right."
"Not going to get a smack in the mouth for it,"
Rackley grinned, wiping his hands on a rag.
"As I understand it, no," said Markwell. He patted the side of his machine. "First flight tomorrow," he said. He'd flown 9-9 already, of course, bringing it down to Gosel FSB. What Markwell meant was first combat sortie.
"We're going to get her ramp ready soon as we've done the last checkover."
Markwell nodded to the fitter. "Thanks," he said. and walked off the pad, backing so he could enjoy a last look at his bird. It was framed in a little cocoon of light under the heavy shrouds. All around, night had settled on the forest, a full, deep darkness punctured only slightly by faint lights from the camp.
"Looking good, killer?"
Markwell glanced around. Larice Ash stood in the trees at the edge of the mat pad.
"It does, doesn't it?"
Markwell smiled. She walked over to him and produced a bottle of Amasek from the map pocket of her flight baggies.
"Better baptize it, for luck."
She took a deep swig and then passed the bottle to him. Markwell drank too.
"Here's to Double Eagle," Ash said.
Her eyes were bright in the darkness, and there was relish in her voice.
"Things are coming pretty good for you, huh, killer? An infamous rocket assist evasion, your first confirmed, a personalized bird. You're really getting in the game. You got the shine, Markwell. The aura that says you're going to go far.
I guess," he smiled, a little nervous. He took another swig and handed the bottle back to her.
"Maybe my luck is changing at last."
"Oh, I know it is," she said, and stepped up to him, her mouth against his. Her enthusiasm took him by surprise. Rackley jumped down from 99's wing and began searching in the tool trunks for a number 3 rotator.
"Hey, Chief,"
said one of his men. Rackley looked up, nodding, and followed the man's gaze, locating the 2 entwined figures in the shadows of the path. He snorted a laugh.
"And the kid was so sure he wasn't going to get a smack in the mouth.